This leadership platform is brought to you by MyWay. For car and home insurance, visit myway.co.za. MyWay is an authorized financial services provider.
This is Leadership Platform Live. I'm Adrian Groenewald. Always great to be with you. Today is a very different show, but very important, I think. Let's know where we come from. We're going to look at leadership behind the scenes in 1994 with a great guest, someone who was right there and who could probably have influenced a change in the course of South Africa's history. If we don't appreciate these kind of things, then I'm not sure we appreciate where we are today. So do stay with us and join us during the course of the show next hour. Thanks.
Wait, don't go, Michelle. Sarah has something she wants to say to you.
We've known each other so long. You're such a happy person. I just can't see you go through this again. I can't see you hold out for that bonus only to lose it when you have to claim. You deserve your rewards even if you claim. I want you to come with me to MyWay.
Do a friend a favor. Introduce them to the benefits of MyWay and you could earn $1,000. Get more rewards more often with myway.co.za. Why any other way? MyWay is an authorized financial services provider. T's and C's apply.
Leadership Platform Live, I'm Adrian Groenewald. It's Monday, your weekly leadership dose. So stay tuned and hopefully we can inspire you to be a better leader. It is going to be a slightly different show. I've always wanted to really look at what happened in 1994. And we've got a special guest in the studio, of course, with me, as usual, Louis Groenewald, and we've got Gareth Armstrong. Welcome, gents.
Yeah, thanks.
How do you feel about this? Digging into history, looking at what really happened behind the scenes? And here's a question. I ask myself, and I did now on your show at the end of it, Gareth, where would I have been today if South Africa went to war? If we went the route of a bloodbath, would I have been married, kids? Would I be driving what I'm driving? Would I have my own business? I don't know. But man, it was so, so close. So a lot of leadership decisions were made behind the scenes, which most South Africans don't have a clue about, understandably so. But today we're going to try and give you insight. With someone very special. Your comments, Dad?
Well, I've given this a lot of thought, Adrian, over the years, being an older guy and also I think things through. But today's very special because my older brother is our special guest, and he's always been an icon in my life, and it's a real pleasure being with him on this show.
Go to leadershipplatform.com, that's the website, to read articles on leadership and to make comments on the show and suggest leaders you'd like us to interview. That's one word, leadershipplatform.com, one P in the middle. And of course, you may want to write down this number. If you want to call us during the course of the show, you're more than welcome. So you'd have to write this down. I won't give you the number a lot because we'll be so in-depth in our conversation, I can promise you. But it's 086-155-189, 086-155-189. 155-189. You can tweet at Leadership P Form. P is for Platt. So it's Leadership P Form. And of course, through WeChat, you can send a message. So today, we're not going to look at the state of leadership because there's too much to talk about.
My heart's breaking, Adrian.
So, Gareth, you'll have to throw in your question for the younger generation. I think some of the audience today, gosh, may not even have been born in 94, 93. When our nation's history could have changed. But before I tell you who our special guest is, I believe we need to remember where South Africa comes from. That's our leadership legacy, but from all angles. Now, a lot of leadership happened behind the scenes, a lot of decisions, good and bad, of course. Leaders never get it all right. I think what we refer to as a miraculous transition is well documented from a Nelson Mandela angle or from a F.W. de Klerk angle. But what about leaders who truly, in my view, could have changed the course of our history? What about leaders, there are different leaders, that we don't always hear enough from? I can promise you, even leaders that Nelson Mandela himself admired, and a lot of other top politicians and struggle icons that I have bumped into over the years admire the leader that we're going to talk to today. He's in the studio, the former Chief Director of Military Intelligence, Major General Tini Groenewald. He was also the head of Branch National Intelligence Interpretation. It was a division that interpreted, he can tell us more, but it interpreted all the military intelligence coming from all kinds of angles. And I'll tell you where this placed him. This placed General Groenewald in the cabinet very often. So he saw P.W. Botha and his senior leaders function to some degree. And he had to give that interpreted information through to them so that they could make decisions. So we'll ask him some very interesting questions. But his career took him from where to where. It took him from a pilot, top in his class, and we'll talk about that for a minute, all the way through to being at the very high levels of military leadership, as I said, a major general, and then somehow a twist in his career, if I can call it a career, certainly in his life. That twist was getting involved in politics. Trust me, it's the last thing that any general wants to do, is to get involved in politics. We'll ask him how that happened. And the biggest mobilization of Afrikaners ever in the history of this country happened when those generals came together and decided they needed to do something. And today he's a businessman, advisor. So he's touched on many areas of life and can definitely talk about leadership. General Groenewald, welcome to Leadership Platform.
Thank you very much, Adrian.
So General, usually we have a development feature before we start the actual interview. But in my I've had many conversations with you over the years, but in our almost three-hour conversation on Saturday, you mentioned some key leadership principles that you learned over the years, and when you went through your military career, the best leadership development happened. I mean, that was available to military officers. But also you applied some, most, maybe all of these principles during that miraculous period, or I don't know what to call it, in 93, 94. So for our development feature, we're going to ask you to share those four or five principles with us. What's that leadership model, philosophy, if I can call it? Share that with us, and then from there we'll go on into the interview. And stay tuned, because we're going to talk about what happened, what these generals did. I watched a documentary called Bloody Miracle, I think is the name, where General Viljoen and also General Groenewald feature, and Mac Maharaj himself on that video says, and I'm just quoting verbatim, that these two generals could have changed the course of our nation. It could have gone to a bloodbath. So we're going to explore that. And if you hear it firsthand today from the horse's mouth, I think you will appreciate where we are today more than ever before. General, those leadership principles, please.
Thank you, Adrian. I think in any process of planning, there are seven very important, call it steps, call it principles.
Okay.
And just very briefly, the first is knowledge of the situation. You cannot plan if you don't have thorough knowledge of the situation. And this basically means intelligence.
Facts, as I thought.
Secondly, you must know exactly what your aim is. Because your aim, every step you take, any part of your planning, is also always referred back to your aim. How does this influence your aim? Thirdly, you must devise a strategy. Strategy is more the philosophy. It's not tactics, and it's philosophy. Fourthly, you must then determine what possible courses of action do you have. And you never settle with just one. You must determine at least three or four courses of action and then decide which would be the best course of action. With every one of these courses of action, you must also ask the question, fifthly, what will the results be? If you take that course of action, what will the result of that action be? Sixthly, determine who must conduct the operation. In other words, your senior officers or commanders, who must do it? You must have the experts. You must know who they are and where they are. And then only you go over to plan every action in detail. Those are the seven important steps which we have always utilized in every military operation or any other operation.
That's fascinating. Dad, if I look at that, it certainly coordinates with the process that we use to help leaders create movement in organizations. A lot of it is very, very close to that. I mean, even when you decide who should implement your specific movement, that's the structure. You must get someone in place to actually do it.
I was thinking along those lines, Arjun, as well, and it just proves that good leadership are always universal. It's applicable no matter where you are.
Yeah, military, business, doesn't matter where, family. Okay, so General, thank you. I think you would say that you applied a lot of that in your career and during that very dynamic period. I know it's not something one should long back for, 94, but I remember it's almost as though there was a vibe in the country, positive and negative. There was energy, positive and negative. There was a purpose for different factions. I look at our country today and I say, where's the energy? Where are we steering the energy to? What kind of leadership purpose do we have? And then, of course, there would be. But at that time, everything was on a knife's edge. Now, before we go to that period where you can give us some insights as you engage with the Nelson Mandelas and the Mbekis and the Zumas and all of them, as well as the so-called right wing, as they were called at the time. Quickly, your name, Tini. Where does that come from? So General Tini Groenewald, the Tini comes from where?
That is a history.
Let's do it briefly.
Tux, in the Tux Rag magazine, they had a character called Tabatini.
Mm.
Tabatini was the guy who fused Africa's lights with a catty slingshot. You know, if lightning struck, then Tabatini would strike back. And at flying school.
But like Chuck Norris today, you know, the jokes around
right,
Chuck
that's
Norris.
Right. And at flying school once, I had a bit of a clash with some of my comrades. And one of the chaps turned around and asked me the question, who the hell do you think you are? Tabatini. That's where the name comes from.
And that stayed, eh?
It stayed.
Yeah, but your real name is Peter.
Peter Hendrik, yeah.
Peter Hendrik.
Arjun, can I just mention that Tini also came from his Air Force gym days when he used to do some wrestling. Mm. Now, I was 4 or 5 years younger. He used to come home, and then him and I used to go to the beach, and we used to have this heavyweight wrestling. And I used to mess him up. This is part of the fun. People came down in droves to watch us.
Oh, really?
as we did this on the beach.
Two Tabatinis fighting it out. Oh. You became a pilot. We're just going to jump forward. And as a pilot, your plane actually came down.
Yes, I was flying from Petersburg down to Langebaanweg in a Vampire. No, the old Vampire was the twin-tailed first jet aircraft that we had. And I had engine failure, bearing failure. And I had to do a forced landing, which I did at Pietersville.
Mm.
Now, the reason why I did a forced landing was you don't, in the single-seater Vampire, there was no ejection seat.
Okay.
The double-seater, which came out subsequently, had two Martin Bakers, which was excellent. Now, if you tried to climb out of the single-seater, you were thrown back against the tail. And you were either killed or maimed completely. To give you an example, one of the pilots who tried to climb out over the Karoo, his legs hit the boom, and he landed on the ground with two broken legs, and the aircraft landed 100 yards from him and set the field alight, and he was burned to death. This to give you an idea.
Okay.
The only successful ejection ever was Glenn Whitehead when he collided with a saber, and the saber took off the tail.
Sure.
And then he climbed out, but there was no tail, so he survived.
Okay.
You don't climb out. You try and force land.
Yeah.
It was too short a runway. I went through a donga, which was about 30 foot deep. The aircraft was completely destroyed.
Mm.
Completely destroyed. And after I was released, I walked away from the aircraft. I was extremely fortunate.
Mm. But you were injured.
Well, superficial injuries.
Sure.
I had to push my one eye back. My nose was broken, and so on.
Oh, but small things. Yeah, no, nothing major,
Nothing major.
Tabatini
yeah,
coming
exactly.
through again.
But okay, seriously, Arden, I just want to ask, you know, all leaders we know have their lows and their highs. And a lot of them we've had in the show had some really serious lows, like Natalie Du Toit, for instance, losing her leg. Now, in your case, General, what did it take to come back and to become a career Air Force pilot afterwards and leader?
Well, at that stage, I was a commandant, lieutenant colonel. I was the operational commander at Air Base Petersburg. I flew only when I wanted to fly. That's the first thing. And you had two flying units, one squadron, which flew Sabres. I was a flight commander at one squadron at one stage. And the combat training element, which did, on the Vampires, which is operational conversions. So, for example, we went down to Longyearbyen Weg for an air-to-air camp. And we flipped a coin to see who I would fly with, the Vampire or a Sabre.
Bad flip.
And the coin was the Vampire. So, yes, I went back, and I resumed my flying. I mean, it's like they say a chap who falls off a horse or a kid who falls off a bicycle, put him back immediately, and that's what you do.
Mm.
You go back immediately. But I had an intense dislike for the Vampire after that.
I would understand that. So, General, let's fast forward your career. You go all the way up to General. It's a long career. And you become head of military intelligence, but also very interestingly, the head of a specific branch or intelligence unit that gathered intelligence. And this was like in the 80s.
Yeah.
When P.W. Botha was president. Because of that very important position, now his cabinet had two divisions. One was the actual cabinet where all the ministers sat. Then there was the safety cabinet.
The cabinet was divided into two cabinet committees. The one was the cabinet committee for security, which was called the State Security Council.
That's right.
And the other one was the cabinet committee for welfare.
Mm. Okay.
And but in times of crisis, or as we had at that stage, the State Security Council, in actual fact, took all the relevant decisions.
Mm.
And all your important ministers served on this, even those who did not have a direct security link, like, for example, F.W. de Klerk, who was Minister of Education at that stage, but he was the Transvaal leader, so he served on it.
Okay.
This cabinet committee had three subdivisions. The one was the one for security, which dealt with the internal security situation. The one was intelligence, which had to provide the commanders and the government with intelligence as the situation. And the third was COMOPS, communication operations, which was psychological warfare and so on. Now, the branch National Intelligence Interpretation consisted of a full-time commander.
Yeah.
I happened to have been the first commander. And then two extremely senior at the level of chief directors of all the intelligence departments, like national intelligence, security, police, the defense force, foreign affairs, and so on.
Mm.
And they met. The committee met at 10 o'clock each morning, and they brought all the latest intelligence, evaluated intelligence.
Mm.
We did not work with rumors or information. We worked with evaluated intelligence. And then this committee had the task to interpret it, to basically determine, so what?
Yeah.
And then we set out a situation report which went to all the cabinet ministers and also the heads of government departments.
Yeah.
Every day.
Mm.
And with every meeting of the State Security Council, it was opened by a short intelligence briefing which lasted about 20 minutes.
Mm.
And I was the first one who had to do that.
Mm.
So for 2.5 years, I was present part of the time, sometimes full time, with every meeting of the State Security Council.
Okay. So that put you right there with the decision makers, including P.W. Botha. You met him. I'm not going to say he was a friend, but you knew him fairly well. You saw him as a leader function with his direct reports, if I can call it that, at a very sensitive, difficult, volatile time in our history leading up towards the 90s. How did it go there? I mean, one would think that you share this information with them and they know exactly what decisions to make. Everything is clear to them. But that period also led to your resignation eventually.
Well, what basically happened, I think this is quite important. When you're in that position, you know the full security situation. It was our task to know the enemy, the so-called enemy.
Yeah.
Who was the enemy? It was the ANC and in particular the MK. It was the PAC. It was all the banned organizations.
Yeah.
Not the political parties, but the banned organizations. It was the United Nations. It was everyone who was considered to be an enemy of South Africa.
Opposing the That's government, right. Yeah.
Now, what's also important is, because no one could argue with the intelligence picture which you depicted, you eventually reached a situation where, for example, in 2.5 years, never once did we have to come back and say we were wrong. In 2.5 years, never once.
Yeah.
And you you reach a situation where you are quite influential.
Mm.
And after serving in that position for 2 years, I asked BW, I said, please appoint someone else. It's time for me to go.
Mm.
And he said, why? And I said, do you know how the J. Edgar Hoovers and the Hendrik Vandenbergs are created?
Mm.
They are in a key position for too long a time.
Yeah.
And then they start manipulating intelligence and they start manipulating the decision makers. Now, this is a very important decision, and this is what I made. I understood PW perfectly.
Mm.
I saw him every Thursday, and I gave him a briefing, a detailed briefing.
Mm.
When he was in a bad mood, I did what I had to do, and I got out. When he was in a good mood, quite often he would discuss certain important matters. For example, the problems he had with Buthelezi, Chief Minister Buthelezi.
Mm.
Which was an interesting story in itself.
Mm.
But there was another principle which was also extremely important and which I think all decision makers should remember. Intelligence had to sketch the situation.
Yeah.
But never, never try and influence decision making.
Mm.
The operational people, the commanders, they decided what do you do about. Now, once they have decided what action to take, they normally should refer it back to your intelligence people with a question is, how will the enemy react to this particular plan that we have?
Yeah.
So in that respect, for example, I attended all these Sponbo exercises which he had, which was extremely important. I can tell you some very interesting stories about those.
Yeah.
But that's not relevant today.
Mm.
So what I'd like to say is I got to know PW.
Yeah.
He relied very heavily on those members of the cabinet which were supposed to give him the philosophical inputs.
Mm.
He was not a man who could sit down and write a constitution. He wanted to use his experts to do that.
Mm.
In this particular case, in 2 years' time, they could never give him a constitution, which was just to give you an idea of how poor the cabinet makeup at that stage was. It was extremely poor.
In terms of expertise, in terms of leadership?
Of expertise and leadership. It was a cabinet who long ago had realized that apartheid could no longer work, but they did not know what to do about it.
So they knew we're heading in the wrong direction in that sense, but they didn't have a solution.
They did not have a solution, and I think this is very important.
Mm.
Very important to realize that. Mm. So when I left, I saw PW several times after that. I saw him after he was kicked out of the cabinet, and I got to know him quite well.
Okay. Does the media portray him accurately, in general?
No. No, certainly, as the media certainly does not depict leaders like President Zuma accurately.
Mm. Interesting. We'll ask your views on him towards the end. You left, and I find that interesting, the fact that you would leave when you're in a very powerful position. It says something about your value system, how you were brought up, that you were not power hungry. That's just my personal evaluation.
Well, you know, I'm one of a family of 10 kids. I have 6 brothers and 3 sisters. My father was my tutor in many respects. I learned more from him than from anyone else. Of the 10 children, we had a Christian upbringing. We kept the old tradition of Bukafat. My father's whole philosophy was that he would never force you into any particular direction, but that you should never become an expert or specialize too soon in your career. And of the 10 children, I should just say that 9 still survive. There are no divorces. There are no alcoholics or drug addicted people. We are a very tight family, a very close family, as you of course realize.
And of course, your mother,
my mother
died
was
at 100.
Fantastic, 103.
103.
And she was the most beautiful woman I've known in my life. She really was.
Wonderful person.
Beautiful, and a wonderful person.
Yeah. General, let's jump forward again. You left the military, and you give us a brief version of why and how you got into politics.
Okay, let me just say first of all that after serving as head of the branch National Intelligence Interpretation, PW asked me to assist to get the Bureau of Information off the ground. Those were very difficult times, and they just couldn't get off the ground. So I was with them for 3 years, right until 1989, and the beginning of 1990.
Okay.
And in that period, I suddenly came to the realization that the government did not have the faintest idea of where they were heading.
Sure.
Not the faintest idea. I, in actual fact, explained it to F.W. de Klerk when I asked for early retirement, and he said, why? I told him I would compare you with, I see you have many names in history. In European history, perhaps Neville Chamberlain, who with his policy of appeasement was a great cause to World War II, biggest slaughter of mankind. I said, in South African history, perhaps Piet Retief. It wasn't wrong for Piet Retief to negotiate with Dingaan. It wasn't wrong to make an agreement. But when he disarmed his commander and he put himself
In a weak position,
right in the kraal of someone who certainly wasn't a Christian, it not only led to his death and that of his commander, but to the biggest bloodshed in South Africa, the Battle of Blood River.
Did he like it when you said those things to him?
I said, and you, Mr. President, you have already neutralized your defense force. You have already placed yourself in the hands of the ANC. And your actions is going to lead to the biggest bloodbath this country's ever seen. So he told me to push off in many words, yeah.
And so you did.
So I did.
But you came back to play another role. How did you then get into the meeting with Constant Viljoen?
Okay.
And just before we look at that, are we going to take a quick break? Let's start with that quickly, and then we'll take a break.
Let me say.
How did you get into that position?
Okay, let me say that. I never had the intention of getting involved in politics.
No.
I was going to become involved in the communication field. That's a story of its own. But in the process, I was requested by an organization called the Boere Vryheidsbeweging, with some very, very prominent and respectful leaders like Wally Grant, Professor Wally Grant, so on. I was asked to assist them in creating unity amongst the Afrikaner people. And I did that, and it became a full-time job. I became the sort of executive officer. We created an organization which was called the Committee of 23, And then we started liaising with other organizations, political and non-political.
Yeah.
And eventually the Committee of 23 became the National Unity Committee.
Yeah.
And the National Unity Committee then decided that we had to do something about the situation.
Okay.
And that led to the creation of the Afrikaner Volksfront and also the Committee of Generals.
Did you approach Constant Viljoen then, based
yes.
coming from that committee, you went to him and said, we want you to come on board?
Well, several people had approached Constant. And he was a farmer at that stage.
Mm, already, yeah.
And his attitude was, give me the political solution because I don't see a political solution.
Mm.
But give me the political solution and I will assist you.
Mm.
And eventually, through people like Dries Prouvaire, who was the president of the Transvaal Agricultural Union, and a lot of other prominent people, Constant then agreed to advise the Afrikaner Volksfront on actions.
Okay. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty after this quick break. Stay with us.
What's this?
This is an intervention, Jono. This just isn't you. I watched you throw your life away on those phone calls. It's time to make a change, Jono. I want you to value your time more. Do it all online and earn yourself up to 500 rand a year extra on top of your My Rewards. I want so much for you, Jono. I want you to come with me to My Way.
Do a friend a favor. Introduce them to the benefits of My Way and you could earn $1,000. Get more rewards more often with myway.co.za. Why any other way? My Way is an authorized financial services provider. T's and C's apply.
Leadership Platform, I'm Adrian Groenewald. We're talking to former Major General Tini Groenewald, who headed up military intelligence and intelligence interpretation. And we're now where he left his military job and started getting involved in trying to unite the Afrikaner nation in the early 90s. But now, General, let's just, you brought in Constant Viljoen. Let's just, you know, we could talk about this for hours, but let's just jump forward. Why did the generals, let's say the mobilizing of those couple of generals, in the end, it seemed like you and Constant Viljoen are highlighted very much in this process, but why did you decide at the time on I'll call it a three-pronged strategy? You needed to mobilize the Afrikaners, then negotiation was the next phase, and if that didn't work, to go into violence. When did you decide on that, and why? And then we'll build on that.
Okay. With the creation of the Afrikaner Volksfront, in which the so-called right-wing political parties were quite prominent, they couldn't come to any concrete plan of how to achieve self-determination for the Afrikaner people.
Mm.
Then Dries Prouvaire, who was the president of the Transvaal Agricultural Union, a person who played a very, very important part in this transitional period, he actually then suggested that they appoint a committee of four generals under the leadership of General Constant Viljoen, and it included myself, General Bishop, who is an army man, and Visser, who was a policeman. And for them, then, to devise a strategy that we should follow.
Mm.
We sat down on Constant's farm one Saturday afternoon, and I proposed a strategy which provided for the three phases. First of all, we must mobilize the Afrikaner people and all those who agreed with the principle of self-determination. And until we became a powerful force to be reckoned with.
Mm.
Now, I think it's extremely important to realize that the basis of this phase in the strategy was that we would not initiate negotiations.
Yeah.
We would build up a force, not necessarily a military force, but a force which our opponents would realize that they had to do something about it. They had to approach us to negotiate.
So a sign of mobilization being successful was that you were approached.
That's right. Now, the four generals, basically, assisted by the politicians, started organizing political meetings throughout the country. And, Adrian, I'd like to tell you, I've never seen anything like that.
that enthusiasm.
Mm.
Hundreds of thousands of people attended these meetings. And it was not only the Afrikaner people. For example, the meeting I addressed in Richard Bay, which was, there were so many people. We had to put up loudspeakers outside the town hall.
Mm.
And the majority of the people were English-speaking. In actual fact, I had to address them in English on the principle of self-determination. It really was something to realize. It scared me. It scared me to see the enthusiasm that we had.
There was a need. There was a desire for leadership. There was a desire for unity, clarity, call it what you want.
But now I must say this. I eventually realized that this mobilization and the feelings that these people was not that we would have to do something about it. It was that the generals would do it.
Yeah, they must do
they
this
must
for
do,
us.
They must do it.
Mm. Interesting.
So now that was the first phase. The second phase then, and now that phase would continue right up till the critical time. And that phase would then be followed by the negotiation phase.
Yeah.
Now, just to give you an idea, the mobilization phase, first of all, was directed towards the basically Afrikaner people throughout the country. And then it was expanded to those black ethnic groups that supported self-determination.
Like the Zulus, yeah.
Like the Zulus and Bophuthatswana, President Mongopi, and so on.
Mm.
Even the Siskai with all... And a few small black political parties.
Okay.
And this organization was called COSAG, the Concerned South African Group.
Okay.
And they met. And I was surprised at the complete unity of feeling. I believe that we had started something which could have been a model for future development in South Africa.
Mm.
And then a very important thing happened. At that stage, Dries Brouwer had, because as the leader of the Transvaal Agricultural Union, had contact with certain ANC members on the field of agriculture.
Yeah.
And then they approached him and said, the president wants to talk to you.
To the generals.
And
so phase one was successful.
Phase one was successful.
And then negotiations started.
And then we had this meeting.
Tell us about this first meeting with Mandela. So you walked in, you sat down as the generals with him.
Yes, General Fuluna and myself walked in. And there was President Mandela. And he had one person with him, Jürgen Kugel, who was a businessman. He's still in South Africa. He still plays a key role.
Mm.
And the approach was, from Mandela was basically, look, you know, I realize that there's no way in which the ANC can defeat the Afrikaner people.
Mm.
But there's also no way in which the Afrikaner people can defeat the ANC.
Yeah.
Now, if we continue on the road that we are walking now, we'll end up in a situation very similar to that in the Middle East or in Ireland. Isn't there a peaceful way out of this?
So he was generally seeking a peaceful way. And
can't
Constance
we,
response?
Can't we talk?
Yeah.
And our response was prepared before the time.
Yes.
We wanted negotiations.
Yes.
We said, yes, we'll talk.
Okay.
He then appointed Mbeki and Zuma as the ANC representatives for the talks. And from our side, Constant Fuluna and myself would be the prime negotiators. But we and they would bring in experts in their particular fields when certain matters were discussed. For example, in the agricultural field, yes, Dries Brouwer would be there. The ANC brought in several of their top people when certain matters were discussed.
In the meantime, this was around about when, General? In the 93 somewhere?
This was towards the end of 93, yes.
Okay, so these negotiations went on in the background. In the meantime, CODESA was happening, am I right?
It was happening, yes.
In the background, in Midrand, your negotiations with those senior individuals represented by ANC went well.
Extremely well. Let me say, that we had already started negotiations with the government, the Nationalist Party.
Mm.
And Kosach was really heading towards a very concrete proposals.
Okay.
If we have time, we can talk about those. But the important thing here is the ANC.
Mm.
Now, the negotiations with the ANC progressed up to a stage where we drew up an accord. This was the accord of December, 21st of December, 1993.
And we've got that accord in the studio here today. It's a fresh document.
I must tell you that this is an extremely important document.
Can I just ask, is this the original document? One of the original
surgeons? Yes, this is it. These are the people who signed it.
Okay.
On there, the people who signed it was Ruf Meyer. Yeah.
Let me just say that the 21 December, no, was never signed, and I'll explain to you why.
True, yes.
The accord I'm referring to subsequently was the one of 23 April, which was signed.
Just before the elections.
On the 23rd.
Correct.
Okay. Here's an interesting story there.
That's right. The one in December was not signed.
The one in December is extremely important. And there are certain provisions in this which gives an indication of how well the negotiations had progressed between the ANC and the Afrikaner Volksfront.
Okay, our time is very limited, General. So let's just assume that went really well. You were about to sign it,
right,
but you clearly felt that the NP did not want this to happen. The National Party didn't want it to happen. No. That became an obstacle. Didn't happen.
Two things happened. We had also initiated discussions between Kosach and the ANC and the Nationalist Party.
Yeah.
And this negotiations progressed until a stage where we insisted that the provinces should have certain executive powers.
Yes.
And at our last meeting, I specifically asked Joe Slovo, I said, Joe, are you going to allow any executive powers for the provinces? And he said, no. Then I got up and I walked out. And I said, well, there's no purpose in continuing this negotiation. Now, that was very close to the 21st of December.
Mm.
And then Buthelezi, Mongopi, and so on followed us. And that ended the negotiations of Kosach.
Okay.
So when it came to the signing of the agreement, the memorandum of agreement between the African National Congress and the Afrikaner Volksfront, General Viljoen said, we cannot sign this document because we would be letting down our friends, basically, the Kosach people.
So
the ANC understood this. They understood this.
Mm.
And they pulled back. And we continued the negotiations with the ANC. It did not mean an end. We continued the negotiations. Now, Adrian, this led to a situation where in April, we drew up the accord with both the ANC and the NP.
Yeah.
This was a shortened version of the 21st December agreement. And this accord, basically, it's important just even with our limited time to understand that this accord provided, first of all, that on the side of the Afrikaner Volksfront, we would not use force. We would not disrupt the election. On the ANC side, they agreed to continue the negotiation on Afrikaner self-determination.
Yes.
And set up mechanisms to achieve this.
Mm.
And thirdly, that when we continue after the election, the negotiations, that if we could not come to agreement, both parties would subject themselves to international mediation.
Okay.
That document is still valid. Still valid.
But General, yet we came very close to war.
Okay.
Tell us why. How did that transpire?
Now, we certainly realized that the National Party then would not sign the agreement.
Mm.
And there were certain elements within the ANC which said, well, we had progressed so far. We don't need, there's no need to sign this. Now, in one of the briefings with the ambassadors, where we briefed the ambassadors,
yes,
all the foreign ambassadors, General Viljoen had a long discussion with the American ambassador.
Mm.
And he then asked the general, he says, "General, if you can't come to an agreement and you decide you are going to use violence, will you let me know?"
Mm.
So the general says, "I'll consider it." And round about the 20th of April.
That's and the elections was on that?
26th. We decided, well, now we have no option. We had to resort to violence.
Mm.
So General Viljoen then called in the American ambassador, and he told him.
And this very few people know.
And that was on the 22nd of April. He called him in. He said, "I promised you that I would let you know, and we could not come to an agreement. Both parties refused to sign the document, and we now have no other option but to resort to violence."
Mm.
And then he asked, he said, "General, please give us 48 hours. General said, "Sorry, we can't give you 48 hours. Then our plans would become known." He said, "Well, give us 24 hours. He says, "No, I can't give you 24 hours. Eventually, they agreed on 8 hours.
Yeah.
And within 8 hours, the American ambassador came back and he said, "Both parties have agreed to sign the accord tomorrow, 23rd at 10 o'clock in the morning, wow, the Union buildings."
Sure, last minute stuff. But General, now, in the meantime, you couldn't just wait for that signing.
No.
You and the generals, specifically General Viljoen, asked you to come with plans, contingency plans.
Yes.
Just let the South Africans know what you did. One or two or three things. I know you flew to Mozambique. You guys had incredible plans in place to go over into violence.
Let me say, first of all, that people always thought that the actions by General Viljoen would be a full-scale war.
Mm.
That was not the plan. The plan was, first of all, to occupy certain key points. Now, because of the position we were in, I was in, I had a copy of the key points register, which was the security plans for all the so-called key points.
Mm.
These are key points like these.
Nkandla wasn't on that list yet.
No, they're not yet. That was for example, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, Eskom, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
And we had plans, and we had identified the people who would occupy those lands. We would then also take over certain towns, which we considered to be a part of the Volksstaat.
Mm.
We would have no military offensive outside this. So if the defense force was now called upon to take action, they would now have to act against people who were not committing any violence.
Mm.
And very few South Africans and very few Afrikaners in the defense force would be part of such an agreement.
Mm.
We also knew that more than half of the defense force supported General Viljoen.
Mm.
So you could see we were in an extremely strong position.
Mm.
The other point was, if this had to develop into a guerrilla war,
yeah,
one of the absolute requirements was that we should have a base area from where we could operate.
Mm.
So I was instructed by General Viljoen to visit Jonas Savimbi, the leader of UNITA in Angola, and ask if he would support us. Then I flew up illegally in a light aircraft to, first of all, Jamba, and from there through to an airfield just north of Huambu, in the central part of Angola. And I met with the Savimbi 3 o'clock in the morning. We talked until 5 o'clock in the morning, and then I came back.
Mm.
And in these talks, Savimbi not only said, "Inform General Viljoen that everything I have at my disposal is his. And if I give him everything, it wouldn't be a fraction of what he has done for us."
Mm.
I then ventured and I said, "Look, if we had to kidnap the key political figures and fly them out to Angola."
That's
to
Mandela, de Klerk, and all of them.
That's right. ANC and the MP, basically. To fly them out to now negotiate on our terms. Would you provide us with those facilities? And he said, yes, he would.
Could you have kidnapped them? Did you know where they were? Were you able
to? Yes, we had extremely good intentions as to the movements of the whole top structure of the National Executive Committee. And, of course, the cabinet was easy. Mm. We also had, for example, amongst the bodyguards of President Mandela and these top people, we had two who were working for us.
Mm.
So we had, it was possible. I must admit that we needed a bit more time to make sure that these plans were absolutely foolproof, but we could have done it.
So, General, our time is almost up. Why in the end? Because generals, in general, want war. That's the perception out there. Of course, it's not always true. But, you know, why would you want to be a general and not go to war? Because that's what you're trained to do. In the end, why didn't it happen? Give us a quick answer of why didn't...
I think, first of all, generals know war.
Mm.
They know what warfare is.
Mm.
We also knew that once you start on the path of violence, there's really no end to it. And you create hatred, which would take generations. You see, you look at the Middle East, you look at Ireland, there are examples. The other point too, it wouldn't be war between the Afrikaner and the ANC.
Mm.
It would be a war between the Afrikaner and the Afrikaner. Those in the Defence Force,
yeah,
and those outside the Defence Force.
Mm.
And the MK was no factor. It was no factor. Yeah, it had no military significance whatsoever.
Mm.
I think you must realize that.
Yeah, interesting.
And then, of course, we realized that if we could push through this accord and this agreement, we were establishing the base for peaceful negotiations and development in the future.
Mm. So, General, we're 20 years down the line. How do you feel it's gone? Could have gone another way. It didn't. If you sat with Zuma right now, almost closing remarks, and you have sat with him a few times actually since, what do you say to him? How are we doing? Good and bad?
We're not doing good. We're not doing good. First of all, I think you should realize that what we had agreed with the ANC in setting up, that occurred after the elections. What went wrong was, first of all, the old problem amongst the Afrikaner people, disunity amongst them, and we lost the power base.
Mm.
The power base to force the ANC, basically, to continue the negotiations. Mm. And their question always was, who do we make the agreement with?
Mm.
Will Eugene de Brandt support you? Will F.W. de Klerk support you? In other words, who are we going to make this agreement with?
Yeah.
The other point is, too, that the Volksfront became a political party, and they lost this aim of a Volksfront. Mm. They just became another professional political party.
Yeah.
But what had happened is we had established the basis of a negotiation between our people and the ANC, which is still a sound foundation on which the future of South Africa can be negotiated.
There's good relationships there.
Yeah.
General, you're finishing a book on this and many other things.
Yes.
Good. Please do.
I'll do that.
It'll be great to see that. Thank you. That's former General Tini Groenewald, Major General, who certainly played a big role, him and General Constant Viljoen and many others, in the background in many cases, to move South Africa forward. And we are grateful for his time. We're going to quickly speak to Greta from My Way. She's got a very interesting, inspirational thought for us. Welcome, Greta.
Hi, Adrian. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. You've got an interesting quote there.
Yes, from Maya Angelou.
Yes.
Says, I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel.
Thank you so much. That's a good comment. Thank you, Greta, from My Way Executive
Thanks,
Team. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So I have these feelings about that time, and that's what leadership does. They invoke these emotions in people, don't they? And then people often long back for those emotions, good and bad, usually the good ones. Well, that's our show for today. Different, but it's good for us to know where we come from. We call it a miraculous transition. It wasn't just certain great individuals who made it happen. There were some great decisions in the background. And General, maybe finally, Constant said to you, or rather, former President Mandela said to you and Constant, and I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, he actually looked you in the eye and told you what a role you played. Can you just end off with that?
Yes, I think after the election, President Mandela admitted that it could not never have been possible without the contribution made by Constant. And subsequently, at every individual head of state that visited South Africa, Mandela saw to it that he was introduced to Constant and that they had a chat. Adrian, if I can say one thing to South Africa,
yes,
they do not realize what an enormous figure Constant Viljoen is. And whatever factors you applied leadership, there's a man who fought for South Africa, was worshipped by those who served under him, but who would never act irresponsibly. And what he did and how he did it was an indication of the leadership qualities of General Constant Viljoen.
Well, General, my view is there was a limited ego both in you and General Viljoen. If there was ego and pride, things could have gone horribly wrong. And for that, I am personally very grateful. Next week, we will speak to some key media leaders about the obstacles in our society. What is currently, fast forward from that period, 94, 20 years later, there are lots of obstacles, lots of positives in our country, but certainly lots of leadership obstacles. We'll speak to some key media personalities, individuals who are exposed to the issues in our society on a regular basis. We've got Joseph Abramji, head of news and current affairs at Prime Media. And we're looking at some editors who have also agreed to join us in the studio. So that'll be an interesting conversation with media leaders. And of course, now you have to stay tuned for Candid Business with Alice Mnyandu and Arnie Hicks. We look forward to being with you next week again, next Monday, the 18th. Have a good week and keep creating movement as leaders out there. Just create movement. We need great leadership in our country. Have a good week.
This leadership platform is brought to you by MyWay. For a quick quote, download the MyWay app from your app store today. MyWay is an authorized financial services provider.
Wait, don't go, Michelle. Sarah has something she wants to say to you.
We've known each other so long. You're such a happy person. I just can't see you go through this again. I can't see you hold out for that bonus only to lose it when you have to claim. You deserve your rewards even if you claim. I want you to come with me to MyWay.
Do a friend a favor. Introduce them to the benefits of MyWay and you could earn $1,000. Get more rewards more often with MyWay.co.za. Why any other way? MyWay is an authorized financial services provider. T's and C's apply.